Welcome into Q&A Friday with me. I'm Friday. Today we're talking about what the target margin ought to be per client. How much money should each client make you in an accounting firm? How did I capacity plan when I was running an accounting firm? What do you do if an remote employee starts to ghost you? How do you set boundaries? One of my favorite stories from a listener of this podcast and how they turned their busy season on its head. Newsletter frequency, what platforms to consider for your newsletter, and a roundup of a whole bunch of cool stuff that people shared from last week when we were talking office setups. What a fun week that was. Come on in, let's do it. This one's from Aruvum. I've never understood how to say it. Is it Aruvum? What was the target gross profit margin per customer? Ain't this a million-dollar question? A couple things I can share. I didn't generally measure things down to the customer level. I kind of measured this stuff on more of a portfolio basis. If you focus too much on, that's not to say that customer to customer doesn't matter and that shouldn't be a factor in deciding to fire clients also. But if we dwell too much on the specific client-by-client profit margins, it can keep us from doing the right thing for the business as a whole. So for example, when we transitioned a tax firm from, you know, doing hourly billing on like 1,000 individual tax returns a year, a lot of the stress there, and this will be the case for anyone transitioning to something closer to value billing from hourly billing, a lot of the stress there is on, well, how are we going to like nickel and dime these people at scale for the folks that give us things in very inconvenient ways, or there's, you know, big variability from year to year. And what you find if you instead reframe what you're thinking about in the terms of like, this is a portfolio, you spend less time stressing over the nitty gritty of getting that down to the client by client basis and more on the decisions that will make the business overall more profitable. And so, for example, if I'm super fixated on a specific client and I'm like, well, if we implement this software, we're probably gonna be upside down for the next year on time and it's not gonna be helpful, and so we don't do it. But if it turns out that software is really helpful on a bunch of other engagements, then the time you just invested there across the rest of the business can actually save you a bunch of time. So getting too targeted with like client level yardsticks can be a trap, just something to be aware of. In terms of an absolute answer for what margins you ought to be operating at, it's a big spectrum and people come down in different places here. Actually, Brandon Hall, who's got a great newsletter, the issue that went out a couple of weeks ago is just around your profit metrics and what sort of margin you are targeting. And Brandon is very much a growth-minded accounting firm owner, which was not me. I was growth-minded from the standpoint that we're going to keep refining and keep doing things better. And oftentimes that meant revenue growth. He's like the more traditional form of growing. Well, not necessarily not doing those other things I just said, but he's looking to like acquisition, stuff like that. This is from his newsletter. He said, anchoring in a high profitability number can result in, one, you personally making a lot of money, but still feeling like you're running a bad business. Or two, you personally making a lot of money, but working like a dog to avoid having to hire the necessary people. He's making the argument that growth is an investment, and whether it's 10% or 35%, you need to just be aware of the stage in which you are in. Sometimes clinging to profits can get in the way of making the right investments in the firm. And if you think about like legacy firms and like navigating legacy firms, I definitely ran into this. There's like sticker shock for a lot of things, right? Like transitioning, for example, to a more traditional org chart where you've got like middle managers requires spending more on people and training and investing more in people than you ever have before. But ultimately, that's the only way to get all the work off of what was previously the partner's back. That's how you relieve yourself. The folks who struggle to get out from under their own workload, it's usually one of two things. Or both that they're struggling with. One, building systems. A lack of systems ends up requiring too much of expertise. So if you have no systems, it requires a very high skill person to do anything. If you have great systems, you're able to lean more into like labor arbitrage, like getting low skilled people to do high value work. So a lack of systems can leave you with too much. But then an unwillingness to hire a high enough level person to help you can also get in the way here. And if it means you've got to make the most expensive hire you have ever made to truly relieve you of certain duties, oftentimes that's a worthwhile investment to make. And it is another example of how we perpetually undervalue ourselves and our time. And I can tell you there are compounding benefits long-term over the course of your career to valuing your own time more. Because every time you give up a task, it means you're able to start doing a better task or learn a better thing or invest more time in yourself or get on a treadmill, like things that need to happen. When we talk about developing team members and how we wanted them to evolve into better stuff, we tried to look at it in very tactical ways. If I want you to be in this place 12 months, then what do your tasks look like in 12 months? And how do we ensure that those evolve to where they need to be? Who's going to take over the ones you're doing now? Like getting real nuts and bolts around it. So hard to get to an absolute right answer here. There are small tax firms that can run north of 50% margin. Bookkeeping, historically, if you think about what bookkeeping has been, it has historically been lower margin, more 10 to 25. That being said, I think there is a real push to change exactly what bookkeeping is. And that's why, that's why the ICPA tries to call it cloud accounting services. And like people have their different versions of that. And even advisory, I would argue, oftentimes is really just like controllership type of stuff, not like CFO duties. But, our firm in the client-facing context, we called accounting managed accounting, kind of like managed IT. I wanted to frame it as we're actually carving out the whole accounting department. So you're not comparing us to the cost of a bookkeeper, you're comparing us to the cost of having to hire people in-house to do it. And that stuff we could do at really good margins. Now, my journey building that from zero to, I think it was about $1.5 million at its peak. In the beginning, it wasn't profitable and we were growing it really quickly. And like that was an investment that we were willing to make to get it to, in the end, what was every bit as profitable as like our best paying tax work. So as with all things, it depends. If you're an owner of a small firm, it could be a season of life thing. It could be a how motivated am I feeling right now kind of thing. Like I just met with somebody whose kids were just leaving the house and they've got like kind of this renewed energy to take on some big projects. That may be a time to where you can justify taking less margin to like rebuild into kind of a new different version of yourself. So there isn't a perfect answer here besides make it grow. And growth can be an increasing number. Growth can also be finding a better way to do the same thing. So just like in how you price your services, I tell people don't fixate on what anybody else says, really. Don't fixate on benchmarks or anything like that. Fixate on getting from A to B, where you are right now, to something that looks better. Not necessarily bigger number, but better. That's all that really matters. That's where I think a lot of the value pricing discussion, and there's a lot of examples of thought leadership that are so far out of reach for people that they're not particularly helpful. Where like you can see the idea, great, you sold me on this slide deck. That still doesn't show me how to get from where I am today to there. And so to me, like the much more practical version of that is learning that stuff and learning the benefits of it, but trying to stay razor focused on here's where I am right now. How do I get to a better place a quarter from now, given the state of my business today? This episode is sponsored in part by Cloud Accountant Staffing. Y'all know I'm a big advocate of hiring offshore. One of the biggest changes I made in my firm, we transitioned a legacy firm from 100% onshore local hiring to 100% distributed US and then 100% distributed globally hiring. And honestly, is the best thing we did. It virtually alleviated all of our hiring pains, completely changed how we thought about staffing projects and the type of work that we wanted to bring on. Because you know what? The folks we hired offshore, really freaking good. A lot of misconceptions around the type of people that you hire offshore because your enterprises will oftentimes use offshore folks for like menial work. Absolutely not the case. There are tens of thousands of people working for big four accounting firms, offshore outside the US. You can get folks that can do anything from tax to junior level stuff to super senior level stuff. But try to do that yourself, figure it all out yourself. That's gonna be hard, it's gonna be scary. Really good place to start, Cloud Accountant Staffing. They will hold your hand through that process. Their story is super simple. An accounting firm in the US hired a bunch of people in the Philippines, fell in love with them, but didn't fall in love with the fees they were having to pay to the staffing companies that were managing these employees. So they built their own solution, and now they're starting to pull other accountants in. I'd encourage you, a big tipping point for me was when I was like, I'm gonna stop being opinionated on this and just try to learn. And so I talked with other practitioners, I talked with some of the vendors that would like help you get into offshoring. That really opened things up for me. So if you've been on the fence, I'd encourage you to at least learn about it. And if you start heading down that path, consider Cloud Accountant Staffing. This episode is sponsored in part by LiveFlow. If you've ever thought about selling better paying advisory projects, folks who will pay you top dollar to do a bit of coaching with them each month. Maybe this is a thing that you're already doing. I think one of the most common blockers is not knowing where to start and being overwhelmed by the tools that are out there to do the job. And when a client comes to you for advising, I don't know that what they have front of mind is what kind of wildly complex reporting package do you have to put in front of me, old friend? Now, I think they just want to talk to you. I think that's probably what they want. That's why people use LiveFlow for advising. It gives your spreadsheets brains. It connects your spreadsheet to QuickBooks. It'll auto-sync data back and forth to Google Sheets, because sometimes a spreadsheet, friends, sometimes it's all you need. Now, LiveFlow's got a whole pile of advisory templates on their site. If you haven't sold advisory before, these things are a great place to start. Literally spin it up, connect it with LiveFlow, and Bob's your uncle. It's pushing that data in. You've got some really good talking points to go through with your client. And because it is a spreadsheet, it's totally customizable. You can add stuff, remove stuff. You can even move cells around and they will continue syncing. You can reference the syncing cells, the sunk cells, reference the syncers from like another sheet if you're building your own sort of summary report. If you're layering advisory on top of bookkeeping work, kind of puts that advisory reporting on autopilot for you. Now, they recently kicked off a consolidations functionality. Makes it super easy to roll up a bunch of different companies. If you work with company groups, as I once did, that is a massive pain in my hiney at the end of each month or quarter when we got to roll all that stuff up together. LiveFlow now makes that super easy whether those companies have matching chart of accounts or not. So if you're thinking advisory opportunities, think about LiveFlow. It's a way to build all that stuff right into a spreadsheet where you're probably already pretty comfortable. Learn more about that one, check out the link in the show notes. How did I manage capacity planning? Oh, good question. Not very well. Bodies, overhiring. So we had, in my last firm, we had kind of two sides of this. We had tax, and then we had this managed accounting sort of back office management. The managed accounting side was much more easy to plan around because it was a year-round sort of thing. We basically carved that team up into more of the production side and the client-facing side. So we had onshore folks that were managing the clients, and then we had a growing team of super talented folks in the Philippines that were doing the bulk of the heavy lifting on stuff like bill pay and the actual write-up work and all that. And those people very quickly got to be every bit as good as the onshore people that we had. And we weren't even hiring very experienced people in the Philippines. We were hiring like early 20-somethings kids straight out of college. So that accounting practice, the capacity planning was much easier to manage because it was like a month over month sort of thing, where it was like a little more kind of seat of the pants, like how are we doing? How many new clients are we from needing another hire for this pod or that pod? That actual like splitting of the production from the relationship management was also helpful there. So for example, if you've got six people who are just a core team in charge of all of the write-up, that configuration makes it easy to add one more person, as opposed to if you had like three pods and these are, you know, three people pods or something like that. When one pod gets to capacity and another one's kind of sort of at capacity, where do you put that next person? Like, do they then sit between those two pods, or you add one person to a pod and now that pod has way too much capacity? That's kind of a benefit of separating the functional line, getting the work done, from the more client relationship facing pods. That was our approach anyways. So that wasn't very hard to manage on the accounting practice side. On the tax side, we did almost 2,000 tax returns a year. That was a monster. We definitely didn't plan it down to the client by client level. We kind of organized things in portfolios. We would estimate annual attrition, estimate the amount that we would pick up, but it was definitely broad brush strokes. But even then, we had not gotten to the point where we had taken control of when people bring their work into us. So like, and in this next story, we'll actually get into this. If you are not planning out your work when it comes to, if you are a tax firm that is, you know, heavily deadline based, if you're not planning out your firm, I think even if you try to do some version of capacity planning on when you're going to get the work done year round, if clients can bring their work to you anytime and expect you to do it for them at the drop of a hat, you haven't taken control of capacity. All you're doing is like planning how much work could we do across the entire year. But until you control when they give it to you and when you give it back to them, like, you're not controlling capacity yet. I always tell people, if it took you until October 15th to do the last tax return last year, but then next year everybody brought you all of their information on February 1st, it would still take you until October 15th to do all the tax returns, right? And maybe there's some compression there and you would actually get it done earlier, but they make a run on the old bank, everybody brings you their info, like, you're up a crick. So until you're taking control of delivery dates, I don't know that you're actually managing capacity in a tax firm. To that end, I wanted to, and we've talked about this before, who's a listener to this pod, hello, transitioned her tax firm to people basically booking and scheduling when they're going to drop off work and when that work gets returned to them. So it's moving from a approach that says, I'm just going to do this work whenever people bring it to me, to proactively more of a collaboration there to say, I'm going to give you some flexibility in like choosing some dates, but we can only do so much during certain times of the year, and what we're doing and when will be scheduled. Jacob Oberlander, another listener to this pod, guy that first opened my mind to this. Last I heard, they don't work Fridays at all, and there is no fluctuation in busy season at all, and they're a tax firm. They work year round, they schedule all the work out by week. Clients have never known anything different. That's just how they built their business. And when you're building your own business, that's the beauty of it, is you get to make the rules. And it doesn't mean every single client's gonna like that. Just know that if you're not doing it in a way that works for you, you kinda got nobody to blame but yourself. I wrote this incredibly nice thing on Twitter, which is a good reminder of like the power of visibility and community and putting yourself out there and sharing what you're learning. She said, I introduced her to tax Twitter from watching my YouTube videos. It was the summer of 2020. We had just been through a pretty peaceful partnership breakup. An employee that I had trusted and considered a friend left on bad terms. Let's bleep out the name. I've said the name of this person a couple of times. Let's go back and bleep that out. This was a public Twitter reply, but probably for the best. I was a bit unhinged, but excited about recreating our firm the way we wanted. And it started watching YouTube videos. It led me to this incredible group of tax professionals. And I'm very thankful our firm has improved exponentially because of it. Gang, same for me, honestly. Before I found tax Twitter, I was just like a dude in a firm. And the only reality I had was that which was around me, like the random firms that I had stumbled into and like came of age in. And if that's all you know, you can't really be expected to know anything else, right? But like, there's an entire world out there of other people running firms and sharing their journey. And you can learn so much just from the stuff that they're getting right and the stuff that they're getting wrong to avoid those headaches, those things. Oh my gosh, like, it's gonna shave years off your learning process engaging in that. But also, if you're me on the creation side, like, awesome. Like, that's why you do it. That's why you go out there and you be visible and you share the journey. I think we like to be super calculated and like, if I'm gonna go do this training, how many CPE hours am I gonna get, and what is my ROI going to be? And that's how a lot of people think, and there is value in that, and you do need to have like actual technical learning. But there's a whole other side to it that is, man, I just need a friend that does this stuff. Like, I just need to feel understood and heard, because that's a hard thing for, you know, my family to provide, because they don't understand like the nuance of all that stuff. And you know what? I'm convinced like that's why 80% of people are here. So there's about 1,100 people that tune into this pod every day. And it's not because I have something useful to say every day. It genuinely isn't. A lot of the value is like being like, this is my squad. Like, I'm gonna learn a little bit today. This element of maybe like a degree of co-working and feeling like understood, like there's somebody else out there that kind of gets what's happening. And for you, like considering putting stuff out there, know that when you post that stuff publicly, whether anybody engages with you or not, or with that post, it makes a difference. Like, it really does. When people can see that and they're like, oh man, somebody else feels the way that I do, like that super, super makes a difference. And as we are like stumbling through life, trying to increase profits and afford your children's private school and all of those things. Somewhere in there, we ought to try to find a way to make the world a slightly better place for our fellow human beings. And to be able to give that back to the other people who do what you do, like, that's a very rewarding thing. Okay. Can you put this soapbox over there? Thanks. Okay, from Derek Foote. A couple weeks back, we talked about newsletters. He had a follow-up question. Do you think there's a newsletter interval that's a necessary minimum? Do you lose value engaging with an audience if it's too infrequent? What are some of the easiest to use platforms for newsletters? I would say the main point that I'd like to drive home for folks who don't do newsletters is anything is better than nothing. So like if there's one thing I want people to hear, it's that. Even not committing to a fixed cadence, while that is really helpful to hold you accountable and all that, anything is better than nothing. Secondarily, whatever is maintainable is probably the next right answer. If you can only commit to once a quarter, great, that's better than nothing. If you can only commit to once a month, great. Otherwise, like the best cadence is probably weekly. There is an aspect of content creation and consumption that is habitual. And if you want folks to come back and consume that stuff on a regular basis, it really helps if they can build a habit. Like, man, if you've read Atomic Habits, it really opens your mind to how like we just do things because we do things. And oftentimes, most of the time, we don't even think about it at all. We just do it because that's what you do every day. This podcast, that was a big part of the thinking behind this podcast and making it at least daily, at least in the beginning, was it could become habitual. Like daily things are very habitual. You wake up, you take those pills every morning, you have a glass of water every morning, like the daily stuff is very habitual. It still exists on a weekly cadence. So if every Thursday they do this certain thing, like, you know, I've got a day of the week where I go to my kids' gymnastics and there's a podcast that comes out that day of the week. Now, every time when I go to gymnastics, I'm ready to listen to that podcast. Like, that's just kind of how we work. If you go beyond a week, I don't think people really build habits around it at that point. It's too infrequent. But don't let that stop you. Like, don't hear, oh, I can't do it every week, so I shouldn't do it at all. Like, anything's better than nothing because you're starting to build that muscle and putting value out at scale in a one-to-many medium. So yes, I'm sure you do lose some engagement and optimization if it's less frequent than a week, but I wouldn't let that get you in the way. Easiest platforms for newsletters. I'm using Beehive now. MailerLite is a real easy, simple one. ConvertKit's a pretty simple one. I would say it doesn't really matter that much. It's kind of like, I don't know, platforms these days, it's like kind of playing house. 99% of it is like, is it good? The tools will get the job done. Platform's not too huge of a deal. This episode is brought to you in part by TeamUp, helping you recruit top Filipino accountants without any ongoing monthly fees. The difference between TeamUp and all the other offshoring options is that TeamUp helps you hire staff directly. No middleman. You work directly with your new hire in the Philippines. Hire the person, not the company. Guys, gals, gang, here's just a few reasons to hire directly. You have access to higher level talent. Makes sense. You have complete control over team culture and training. They keep 100% of what you pay them, and it's a lot more affordable for you, so you can retain your team for the long term. TeamUp can source accountants with experience working at US or Australian firms, familiar with tools like Xero, QBO, and Dex. Also recruit specialist roles, team leaders, tax specialists, administrative assistants. Thought experiment. What if you had an executive assistant for the first time this tax season? Just throwing it out there. What would they do? Start at that email video I did on the main channel recently. Get help with that stanky old inbox. I digress. TeamUp recruits these talented folks for a flat one-time fee of $4,000. That's it. $4,000 one time. Somebody at Robert Half just did a spit take. Robert Half reference. We ever gonna get Robert Half to sponsor this pod? Not anymore. And they can connect you with an affordable employer of record if you need help with payroll and compliance. Once you hire that person. Big fan of hiring in the Philippines. You know I did a bunch of that. Check out the link in the description to learn more about TeamUp. I won't call this person out specifically on Twitter, but there's a great discussion around a scenario where, here's the tweet, he'd hired a young guy out of Big Four looking for 20 hours a week. He had a side gig with another CPA firm for 20 hours a week, and he wanted 20 or more so he could quit Big Four. He filled that void, basically working half time for him, and now that employee's becoming less and less responsive and starting to ghost them. what would you do? My biggest piece of advice here, and this solves a lot of staffing and expectations problems, is you just have to be really, really explicit about what the deliverables are. This is kind of a benefit of getting away from tracking things based on time. But when you get to the point where everybody has, you know, production expectations of certain types of X number of returns that need to get done, or X amount of billable value that has to get done, like when there's a really clear yardstick of what the output expectation is, then that conversation isn't, are you ghosting me? Are you doing enough? Are you performing well enough? It's, here's the expectation. Let's talk. Is that not going to be reasonable still? Do we need to change what the expectation is? Are you not performing at a high enough level for our firm? Do we need to get you more training? Do you need help? Is there something else going on? It's getting to more of like an output-based employment model. It solves so many issues, specifically this question. And when you're doing distributed work, I mean, there's like the old notion that you could walk around the office and tell who's working and not working, which is kind of a joke. If people are going to steal time from you when they're not in the office, they're going to steal time from you when you're in the office too. But the question of, it seems like they're getting less productive, totally goes away if you can develop that yardstick for how much work they ought to be getting done. Doesn't mean that yardstick is going to be perfect. That's where we get stuck is, well, what about this situation and that situation and this situation? And what about then the game becoming about optimizing for this yardstick? And it's like, yeah, you are changing it to a different game, but it is a better game than people just punching in hours, which are not at all associated with the work that they're getting done and the value and all that. It also gives added flexibility to people who want to work more. And many of your high performers like will be happy to do that. And if you were like me coming of age in the profession, you could look around and be like, man, I'm way higher output than these people. It kind of sucks that I'm like stuck in just the same kind of salary brackets that they are. I would rather my compensation just be tied to my output. Now, I'm not in favor of totally throwing out timesheets. I think if you go that far, in my experience, you are actually going to fail to support some people who need help. Because if you totally move to the output-based model, you're going to have folks that have different needs and may need additional help to be able to get up to speed. And the last thing I want is somebody running themselves into the ground to meet this production quota without me knowing about it. And that can happen, particularly in a distributed work environment where folks don't want to be embarrassed by having to say that out loud, by having to raise their hand for help. So I'm not in favor of totally throwing out timesheets. I can understand why timesheets are evil because of the associations people make with how timesheets have been used in the past. In my experience, timesheets only feel evil when evildoers apply them for their own evil deeds. So if you're struggling with, is this person contributing or not, try to figure out how can we get more explicit with what the expectation of them is. And then it's also easier to make it about the work, not about the person. You know, you're not doing this, you're not doing that. Instead, it is, this is the job, and you're not completing the job as we need it. What do we need to change? That's much better than being like, you're not good at your job, or you're not trying hard enough, or something like that, right? Last, follow-ups on office setups, a bunch of things that people changed last week. Man, I had so much fun last week talking about office setups. Chris, I don't know how to say your last name. Retractable cords. I like that. That's a good hack. Why aren't all cords retractable? That just seems so smart. Kevin Smith, the Fehn chair, F-E-H-N. This thing is pretty wild. It's the Fehn, the F-E-H-N.com. This thing is like, it is like no chair you've ever seen. It's part chair, part mechanical bowl. Like you're sitting on this saddle thing and there's all sorts of various different ways that it can be adjusted and you can like loop your feet under things and flex different ways. It's pretty cool. Not the cheapest thing, but again, like there are people who can genuinely be like debilitated from sitting in chairs all day, every day. So do what you got to do for the old bod. Rex shared, put a lot of effort into duplicating his setup between his home and office. The size and brand of monitors is the only difference now. It's made a huge difference. I can relate to that, man. Nothing is worse than like having to work from a different place, especially for whatever reason in the type of work that we do, that I used to do, like in the technical work, accounting and tax, you got to have that battle station nailed down. Like as soon as something is slightly different, you just feel wildly less productive. It's funny though, for me and the work that I do now, which is very different, a lot of writing and stuff like that, there's actually a lot of benefits now to me working in different places. And it's the first time in my life I could just work on a laptop, which has been, you know, unthinkable when you're doing accounting stuff. But now, like, I can go to a different place and I'm in a different creative mindset. And it's actually helpful for certain things. It's interesting. It's not something I've ever experienced before, because I don't know that that really holds up for accounting work. Unless you are to the point where you are out of the making of the pies and the doing of the work. And then I think those rules really change. Laura B. Chapman, two favorite things are a memory foam chair cushion, go Laura, and a coffee warmer plate. Memory chair cushion, is that like those things that you take to the high school bleachers and sit on them so you don't have to freeze your buns off and they're a little bit padded? That could actually be a great hack if you work for somebody else and you don't have control over the chair that you get to use. And then coffee warmer plate. Laura, if I may be so bold, I don't know if you've ever seen this. This was life altering for a couple of friends of mine. What is it? Oh, the Ember mug, EMBR. It's like a heated mug and it keeps your drink hot all day long. I will go upstairs and it doesn't matter if it's 8 a.m. or if it's 4 p.m, I will usually find my wife's coffee in the microwave. And this mug, it's like got a little battery in it, and it, like, you set the desired temperature that you want the drink to be, and it will keep that drink at that temperature indefinitely. Pretty wild. Ember, it's just ember.com. I got one for my wife, and when I go upstairs, I still find her coffee in the microwave. Accountants for creatives, a standing desk with a walking pad has been life-changing. Average 4 to 5 miles a day walked per day during tax season. Wow. Who are you running from? 4 to 5 miles a day? Also, great name. Name is Accountants for Creatives. Its branding is right, like built in, gang. Take notes. Sarah shared, I too had a glass top desk. It was cold. And one benefit was for extra notes written on the desk until my arm swipes them away. I was real into that idea too at one point. Oh my gosh, my desk should be a whiteboard. And then you're like, well, now I can't set anything on my desk or move anything around. Since you moved to a fully desk, but if you upgrade to the 3-level desk that'll do sit stand, you can't do wheels due to the extra height. Excuse me? So mine goes full standing height and I can do wheels on it. Am I doing something wrong? Like, I don't try to move it when it's at full standing height because I'm not a maniac. That's like driving down the highway with the pop-up camper tent like popped up. If you ever had one of those campers or Pontiac Aztec. And then Troy Constance, favorite desk hack for my home office, minimal desk with no drawers. I added a calculator holster on the underside, just a small cardboard box with the end cut off and hung with double-sided tape. I didn't realize how often it is until I went back to my regular desk and noticed how often I blindly reach for it. Just tape a cardboard box to the underside of your desk. I think it's genius, Troy. Good for you building your own calculator holster. I love that. Love that minimal desk setup. Involves taping cardboard to stuff. No shame in your game. That's it for this week. Thanks for coming and hanging. We'll see you next week.